Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker podcast, sponsored by BetBull. My name is Jake Entwistle and we are going to be diving straight into all of the Champions League fixtures played this week. But before we do that, I of course need to introduce the guests that will be helping me dive into those games, starting with, to my left, Chief Editor at Squawker, Will Hall. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And directly in front of me, Chief Writer at Squawker, Mohammed Butt. Welcome.
How you doing? I like giving everyone a sense of geography.
Yeah, get people inside the room with
You're
us.
You're trying to create a picture in the heads of our listeners.
I've been known as a visual wordsmith.
I'm wearing a black T-shirt, if you're wondering.
There you go.
Wearing a black T-shirt. Yeah.
Well, apart from Jay, me. He's wearing white.
I didn't get the memo.
Yeah, I need to stand out from the crowd. And you may have heard him pop up there before introductions.
Sorry.
You should be. Oliver Young-Miles.
Hello.
Chief voice for hire.
Yeah, exactly. Just here, though.
You're just here. Yeah. And he's on my right. So there you go. You've got a full understanding of the room dynamic. You know exactly the colours of our T-shirts. and before we do our discussions about the Champions League games, we thought it was pretty important to mention that where we stand at the moment with what's happening in football regarding the coronavirus pandemic. As we're recording, I think a meeting of the government's Cobra Committee will be taking place, which may have an impact on whether Premier League games are played behind closed doors this weekend, whether they're potentially suspended, which is something they're looking to avoid. But we do know that La Liga has been suspended for 2 match days at least. Mm-hmm. Real Madrid have self-isolated their first team squad after a player in their first team basketball squad tested positive for coronavirus because they share the same facilities.
I say all teams, not just the first team. I think it's
on their statement, it said Primera Equipo. So it most likely is all their teams that are involved in that Real Madrid training facility, but the Ciudad de Madrid, that they call it, is probably for first-team players. So they're self-isolated. La Liga has been suspended, as I said, for at least 2 match days, and Segunda Liga as well. And Juventus on Tuesday evening announced that Daniele Rugani had tested positive for the virus. So it's moving extremely quickly. You may be listening to this, and there would have been further updates, which is why we didn't want to give you too much information now. One article that we'd like to point you in the way of was the Times article that, again, was published on Tuesday evening, which is very Premier League focused and looks at the potential impact of any restrictions placed on fans going to games, where you can watch the football, what's going to happen to season ticket holders, and the implications and impact on teams in the Premier League and in the other leagues, of course. So I'll point you in that direction if you want to find out more, but you may already know it by the time you are even listening. The first Champions League match we're going to tuck into is an embarrassing result, some may say, for Spurs, in which they lost 4-0 on aggregate to Julian Nagelsmann's RB Leipzig team. Nagelsmann himself becoming the youngest manager in Champions League history to win a Champions League knockout tie. And Mourinho, on the other side of that, has lost his third consecutive knockout tie with his third different club. Nagelsmann was, when he was coming through as a manager, was described as mini Mourinho, baby Mourinho, and was actually 16 years old when Mourinho won his first Champions League title. 16 years later, he's just dumped him out.
Bit of patricide there.
Is this a sign of the times? Has this result even shown that Mourinho might be on the verge of losing a job? He's only recently really took charge of Ollie.
I don't think it's got to that point just
yet.
He
really broke up every single syllable in that question.
The longest question ever. No, I don't think it's got to that point just yet, but he is creaking a little bit. That was his sixth game without a win, which is his worst ever run in his managerial career, which spans nearly 1,000 games, I think. So Spurs are
1,000 years. I just thought.
It feels like that.
Yeah. A millennium.
Spurs reign feels like that. So yeah, it's not good. And it was just all so predictable. Like Spurs at the moment, in the first half of games are just getting obliterated by anyone they play, regardless of their opponent's style of play. Burnley and Leipzig are polar opposites, really, but both just tore Spurs to shreds in the first half. And then it gets to half time, he changes things a little bit, there's a little bit of a lift, but it's all just so reactive at Spurs at the moment, and he just doesn't set them up to succeed, both in terms of his tactics and also how he's talking in press conferences is all very downbeat, and yeah, it's not looking good at the moment.
So one thing that, again, he highlights often, and I feel rightly so to an extent, because he has had some serious injury setbacks, a long list of key players one after another being completely written off for the entire season, it seems like. Bergwijn the latest, where it seemed that he might not play again this season. So that is obviously going to have an impact on how you play and what he wants to do with his team. Has the weakness been in Mourinho that, despite being in the knowledge that he does not have those players, the plan B or plan C, as it were, has not really had any sort of planning behind it at all?
Yeah, he has been unfortunate. The Kane and Son injuries long term have really destabilised what he was trying to do at Tottenham in terms of their offensive play. You know, people have been sort of saying that Spurs have only got four or five injuries and other clubs have had seven, eight injuries throughout the season. But I think that's missing the point in that take Tottenham's two best attackers out of the team for a sustained period, and that is bound to affect them. And then the Bergwijn injury, I think, is just a result of him having to play too much. It's a muscular thing. Well, actually, no, it's an ankle thing. But I mean, the point stands that he's a January arrival, young kid from PSV. They probably wouldn't have expected to have to need him as much as they have. And it's just a result of wear and tear. Same with Ben Davis. Came back from a long-term injury. There's no other left-backs. He's had to play too many games. Breaks down again. So clearly there's squad issues at Tottenham, which isn't down to Mourinho. It's a result of the club not preparing properly since 2018. It's sort of the chickens coming home to roost now. Spurs' inactivity to sign anyone in 2018-19 is now got to a point where that has been shown to be a huge error, because the squad is just breaking down and a rebuild is absolutely necessary. So on that point, he has been unfortunate. But at the same time, he's one of the best paid managers in the world. He's earning £15 million a year at Tottenham. And given his reputation and how much money he's earning and all the rest of it, it's his job to find solutions. And he's just not doing it.
That's the thing, right? Like, I mean, okay, fine, you lose Son. I mean, they have basically someone's injury. They scored the last 20 Villa against Villa, was it? And then since then, you haven't won a game. It's like, and he got injured after that game. So you're thinking, okay, fair enough. But at the same time, you would imagine he would come up with some. I mean, okay, you struggle for three games or so, two games or so, whatever. Okay, fine. But like six games, he's not even shown the slightest idea of how to possibly turn it around. He's playing Dele Alli out front. Dele doesn't want to play out front. Lucas can play out front kind of if you're playing Saudi in transition, but even he's not comfortable there. Like, Troy Parrott is... I know he's 18, he's young, but he's literally a centre-forward. And you need a centre-forward. Try him. What is the worst that could happen? Like, it's not... It can't get worse than it is. Do you know what I mean? Like, and that's what's so strange, is that he hasn't even tried to come up with anything creative. It's just literally putting the healthy bodies up out there. Like, try one of the kids. You never know.
I think the more damning thing, though, is just how much of a shambles Tottenham are at the back.
Oh,
because
yeah.
They haven't really had, Davis aside, they haven't really had any injury problems in that area of the pitch. Obviously, Larissa was out for a while, but he's come back in. But they're just all over the place. Whether they're playing a back five or a back three or a flat back four, they're just getting torn apart every single time.
As far as squad building goes, this is a squad that he praised earlier on in the season before those injuries.
Yeah.
I can't quite remember what the comments were, but they were.
He said he was excited about the quality of the squad.
And
academy.
And given how good opportunity this was for him at this stage in his career, after the way things went at Manchester United, and also having done a little bit of reading on the situation, how it developed, how he was actually hired, I think he bowled Spurs board or whoever was conducting the interviews over with regards to, like, the optimism he had for the squad and where they could go.
Well, that was the
so
whole,
he's
the
really
whole...
painted himself into a corner, and he said some things that perhaps he...
I agree. Like the whole thing with... I think the reason they got rid of Pochettino is because they felt he wasn't getting enough out of the squad. He wasn't maximising the potential of the players that they'd invested in, like Ndombele, Lo Celso to a lesser extent because he'd been injured a lot. And Mourinho came in and said, this is a great squad. You know, we should be doing better. And that's obviously music to Daniel Levy's ears, because it means he doesn't have to go out and buy anyone else. But since then, he's basically just backtracked on that. I mean, like he said, he was excited to work with the squad. But since then, January, he lamented the club's failure to sign Harry Kane back up, which, as we touched upon, is justifiably so. But even so, he's went on and on and on and on, and on about that forever.
For 1,000 years.
And then, yeah, I mean, and then recently lambasting Ndombele for his performances, claiming on Tuesday night as well that RB Leipzig's bench would all make his starting 11.
He did that when he lost to Sevilla with Man United. He was like, oh, they've got players, 2, 3, 4, 5 players that are walking to Man United's team. They're better than Man United. And it's just like, stop exactly negging your team, Jose. Yeah.
I mean, this is the whole thing. I think he has a lot of the things he is saying. I think he has got a point, a genuine point. Like Ndombele has not lived up to expectations. I think when he arrived, everyone was like, this is the Moussa Dembele replacement that we've been looking for ages.
Just because Lele on the end of his name.
Oh, yeah,
easy
exactly
to make that comparison.
The funnier thing is, I think he's more like an Eriksen replacement and Lo Celso is more like a Dembele replacement, because you look at Lo Celso, he's just thriving.
Well, he runs the team. Yeah.
And playing in that deep role, dribbling past guys with a really high completion rate, just eluding it and moving the ball forward. That's what Dembele did. Ndombele is the guy you want to put in the final third role.
Yeah, but in order to carry the ball forward and beat players, you need
good
to
defensive
start
midfielder next year as well.
But you need to start from a deeper place. But you can't just.
But I think a problem for Ndombele has been he had a full pre-season at Tottenham, has had one or two injuries, but not serious ones. They've been like kept keeping out for a week or two. Whereas Lo Celso joined on deadline day, then got injured on international duty, and despite all that, is just running the team. He's by far the best player in the squad, and he's the same age as Ndombele, cost about the same, about $5 million less. So the comparison there is Lo Celso is doing really well and Ndombele is not. Why are the reasons for that? So I do think Mourinho has a point with Ndombele. He's got a point about Kane and Son's injuries. He's got a point about the Leipzig bench players. I did an article yesterday for The Eye, actually, and I calculated that 5 of them would probably get in the Spurs squad. I think Lloris probably keeps his place, but
not after that
Tyler
display.
Adams is a defender, so he gets in over any of Spurs' shambolic
well, he
defenders.
Can play anywhere, Tyler Adams.
Danny Olmo, Yusuf Poulsen, first name on the team sheet if he was at Spurs, because he's a striker.
Yeah,
so he has got a point about all of these things, but I just think it's, as I said, he's getting paid an absolute fortune. He's getting paid nearly double what Pochettino is getting paid to find solutions to these issues.
It's
and
the
if
vibe
anything,
he brings.
He's exacerbating it.
It's the vibe he brings, isn't it? It's this whole negative vibe. Like, even the Ndombele things, Ndombele was awful against Burnley, like really, really bad. But like, everyone was. If he's struggling and he isn't playing as well as you want him to be, certainly he's not as fit as you want him to be. The main thing, when he plays, he looks really good, but it's like only in like 30-minute bursts.
Yeah, so that's the whole thing. So I was looking, he's completed 90 minutes 3 times in the Premier League, and 2 of those were the first 2 games of the season against Villa and City.
So obviously he has stamina issues, fitness issues, but why? I mean, I don't understand why in 2020 Mourinho still thinks digging a player out in public works. His time at United should have taught him that whatever else, you can't dig someone out. That's not what this current generation of footballers respond to. They're not like Walter Samuel, Lucio. You can't dig these guys out. They don't think that they're like, oh yeah, okay, I respect you now because you're insulting me. They're not those guys.
One thing I'd say on that is we don't know what happens behind closed doors.
No,
he could have been saying to Ndombele for weeks, come on, record signing.
That is true. But
you need to pick it up.
Yeah,
but this might be a last resort type thing. But I get what you're saying. It's not something that is usually done.
So to wrap that small bit up, do you think that, I know I sort of said like getting rid of him now, and obviously that's not really going to happen, but say if the season plays out how everyone expects it to, as I said, there are so many factors now that could impact the way fixtures are played, when they're played, and what actually happens. But say a normal Premier League service resumes and continues to the end of the season, what does Mourinho need to do, or rather, what does he need to avoid to be in the job next season? Or do you think because of how much he is paid, he just is automatically going to be in a hot seat next season?
I think he will, unless something disastrous happens. If Spurs don't win a single game from now until the end of the season, which, I mean, looking at how they've played recently isn't beyond the realms of possibility, then maybe Levy might, the sort of warning signs might be going off in his head.
So it has to be a complete catastrophe.
Yeah, I think so. If there's any more signs of him losing the squad, Ndombele might have been the first sort of cracks appearing in public in regards to that, because the whole point in hiring Mourinho is because Levy thought that Pochettino had lost the dressing room. So if Mourinho has lost the dressing room as well, maybe that would force him to act. I think he will be given the summer, but yeah, I mean, it completely depends on whether there's some sort of...
It's not looking great, is it? No, not at all. As you said, it's not really departed from what Pochettino was sacked for. Just quickly, obviously, just to touch on Leipzig and their performance and self, picked out by some Squawker Talker guests as a potential dark horse in Champions League. It escapes me who may have picked it out. But
Call your shot, Jake.
Impressive in both legs. Dominant over Spurs. So maybe Spurs just came up against a much better team. They were playing essentially a 3-2-5 at some points with Angelino and Mukiele as playing as wingers, exploiting the space that Aurier and Sessegnon were leaving as wingbacks themselves. So Nelsmann, as I sort of mentioned in the build-up, maybe 16 years junior to some of the managers that are in the Champions League, and is even younger than Lionel Messi, for example.
Yeah.
But he's showing a complete aptitude and confidence in and how he thinks he can win football matches, and they prove that.
Oh, yeah. This is not even... I mean, I mentioned it earlier. This is not at Man United losing to Sevilla. That Sevilla side was not really any of the great Sevilla sides, and it took a Ben Yedder late cameo to turn it around. This is not that. Leipzig are phenomenal. They would have beaten Spurs if Spurs were playing well. Spurs would have to have Kane and Son at full pelt to stay up, because Leipzig are ridiculous. I mean, just to give you an example of how solid and well-coached they are, they had two fullbacks in their back three. Like two wingbacks, not just like for wingbacks in their back three. And you couldn't tell Klopp. Now, okay, I know Mourinho mentioned it as well. Klosterman and Hulstenberg are very athletic as well, which helps. But it doesn't matter. You can still be athletic and not be a great defender. You know, you look at Kolasinac, for example. You wouldn't put him in a back three, would you? Mm. Like, that's just a disaster. But they're so well drilled. Upamecano is, I mean, look, you thought, everyone's like, oh, Ampadu, they don't need Upamecano. But you saw what he adds when he plays is just, he's so dominant in every phase. He can tackle, he can intercept, he knows where the ball is, where it's going, and he has then the skill to dribble out from the back. And he ran like 50 yards on like two or three occasions, running through the Spurs midfield. They couldn't catch him. It was ridiculous. And then you get further forward. You've got Mukiele getting forward. Angelino suddenly looks like a player reborn. Like, you're like, where was this guy at Man City?
I said as well, he'd be the player I missed in the Premier League.
looking at that, he was incredible.
They have a tactical versatility that, I mean, just to bring you back to earth slightly, when you were making your case for Liverpool to win the Champions League, winners, you were touching upon how they're like an unorthodox boxer in that they can swap between two styles depending on who they draw in the next phase of the competition. So if you take those reasons and apply them to Leipzig, you could make a case for them.
I called them Liverpool light
horses.
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, their goals didn't come. I mean, Werner's their star man, but Werner didn't score either of the goals against in this league. I suppose it was Sabitzer, so the midfielder, popped up with two goals. Now, okay, awful goalkeeping for the first one, you know, and
brilliant header. Just say it.
Yeah,
brilliant header for the second one.
But no, but a brilliant header. Like, you know, got in there near post, lovely heading across goal, goalkeeper positioning, whatever. But it was. They're so good. They're so versatile. Lima was incredible in defensive midfield. He was amazing. Like,
made
really
eight tackles. On
really pitch. Tackling, distributing the ball. Looked like a little Busquets, man. It was incredible. They're so good in almost every level of play. They're so coached. They're well coached. They're talented. I mean, like, they didn't even have to need Danny Olmo to come off the bench and do something. And that's crazy. And they signed...
Who, when we did... Because the Fantastic Four sort of previews that we did for some of the teams...
Yeah.
I was struggling to pick that sort of fourth one, and I went with Olmo because I thought he'd be the game changer, the January signing that had arrived. But as you said, they've proved not to have needed him. They've changed between a 4-2-2-2, which is sort of Leipzig's classic style in recent seasons. Werner playing always alongside someone. Now he's playing in that left wing, which is probably making Liverpool fans more excited the possibility of him joining.
They sold Diego Dem in January. Haven't missed him. And he was the anchor of midfield. It was him and Naby Keita with like the double pivot that was so good.
Dem was the captain after Orban was injured.
Yeah.
Then Dem was named captain, and then Sabitzer picked it up after Dem left.
They're really good at Napoli as well. I think other, like Upamecano and Werner are obviously the two big stars at Leipzig now. They probably walk into pretty much every starting 11 in Europe,
and they're the most wanted of them. If general reporting is to be believed.
But then beyond that, I mean, the rest of the team is obviously very good. But I just think the squad, it's all like, a lot of the players are a very similar level. If you take one player out, another slots in, and there doesn't seem to be any sort of
it's reflected
downgrade.
In how often they rotate in terms of like, I mean, Paulson previously had a quite prominent role in the team. As you said, he's on the bench.
But even with Ampadu the other day, in the first day against Spurs, he's barely played this season. He slotted straight in and was arguably man of the match in that game. And he wasn't even on the bench on
I think he was injured.
Good coaching, man. That's good coaching. Yeah. You have to hand it to Nagelsmann. I mean, and Ralf Rangnick.
And it's good recruitment as
well. Yeah, I was going to say, Ralf Rangnick as well. The Man United were apparently after him for the director of football role, and he, quite sensible, I think, said no, because he basically is like the head of the RB operations. So Leipzig and Salzburg, it's his vision that those clubs are built under. And he does an excellent job. His recruitment teams are fantastic. The Leipzig are great scouters. Salzburg, great scout. They scout great talent. They bring it through and they cultivate it. And the team, the way they've built that squad in Leipzig is incredible. The way they play football is great. Nagelsmann is a huge upgrade as a coach. And I just hope he doesn't go to Bayern Munich. That's all. He's so good.
It's inevitable, isn't it? He's the kind of coach that Spurs should have gone for. He was linked with Spurs. I don't think he would have gone anyway because he'd just gone to Leipzig. But he's a bit young, so Spurs should be looking at.
He's very good.
Well, I don't think age... I think the whole point of this is that we said that being too young, in terms
when it comes to handling egos, I think this one Leipzig doesn't really have anyone that's got amazing.
You don't know that
he's 32 though. He's literally if you brought him to the Premier League, he's literally younger than Hugo Lloris.
He's younger than Messi. But I think the whole point we're trying to make is that is such a antiquated idea. I think
it is, but at the same time,
if they're good enough and they have a clear enough plan, then they should be hired, and we'll probably see it. Depending on who they draw in the quarterfinal. Before we move from one potential Champions League dark horse to another, I told you everything was moving quite quickly, and in a little break, Ollie Young-Miles has checked his phone. Sky Sports reporting that UEFA are now considering a potential suspension of Europa League and Champions League due to the coronavirus outbreak. So, despite me saying that Nagelsmann will have the chance to prove it, he is, if you're good enough, you're old enough, in the quarterfinal. Maybe that opportunity will be robbed by the developments of the coronavirus outbreak.
Well, he's only 32, so he'll still be 33 next season.
So he'll have enough, yeah. But as I mentioned, another potential dark horse, or at least one of the really... They both played on Tuesday evening, and Atalanta have cemented themselves as one of the most entertaining teams.
Will Hall's Atalanta, I believe they're known as.
It's really not. Just
Will does one podcast segment on Atalanta, is the sort of meme. But we have been tracking them in general. Again, we featured them in one of our Fantastic Four graphics. Had Muriel and Zapata in there because just all of their players were scoring so many goals. But it's clearly the duo of Ilicic and Papu Gomez that are leading them through to the Champions League. And specifically in this round, of course, Josip Ilicic, who became the first Atalanta player to score a hat-trick, the first player to score four goals away from home in a Champions League knockout tie, scored all of their goals in the away game behind closed doors against Valencia, and is making a case.
And would have you believe he won both of their penalties?
Yeah, I was going to bring that up. And this is the point. So in the agenda, Will's put as like the mini headline, like why he's your new favourite player. And I think a lot of people were subscribing to that view. He's so mesmerising to watch because he's 6'2", 6'3", but plays like a diminutive playmaker. Excellent ball-striking ability, as you would expect from a left-footer. But also his dribbling ability, and you mentioned his I don't know if he was directly asked, we were trying to find out whether they said how do you win so many penalties, but he discussed to in more length than usual, I won't say at great length because it wasn't exactly a paragraph, but he was talking about how he maneuvered those situations to win penalties. And again, maybe that's...
He said for the first one that he could see the defender going in for the slide tackle and thought, oh, if I cut back then he's going to catch me, and that happened obviously. The second one, it's unclear. It appears that he's suggesting he allowed the ball to bounce past him from the throw-in, because having seen the ground was turf was wet, he thought the bounce would cause it to hit the defender's hand. We'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Because I haven't watched it. I mean, it's just like, it looks like a natural movement, but movement is such a subtle thing that it's difficult. You have to watch
a replay like a million times before.
Yeah, I'm happy to go along with that as well.
And that's probably why, that's why he's such a good attacking player, is because we mentioned it and I said, like, although that maybe sounds a bit far-fetched, it's that that constant awareness of who is around you, checking over your shoulders and understanding the space and the picture that's developing on the pitch lends itself to someone that is going to be more destructive in those final thirds, because they know what the defender's going to do even before the defender knows it. And just to reel off just some more stats about him, I think it's 16 goals in his last 12 games for Atalanta. They are the top scorers in Serie A. And Ewan Dewar from StatsBomb did a really nice graph in which it was matching up the amount of shots teams take per game as well as the number of people they have in the box when those shots are taken. And Atalanta are among the outliers with Man City and PSG in terms of having lots of shots and lots of people in the opposition box. So Ilicic, your favourite player, Atalanta, your new favourite team, because they're so attacking and so entertaining. 4-3 was the second leg score, 8-4 on aggregate, and by all accounts it could have been so much more in both of those games.
I think with Ilicic, just to expand beyond the numbers as to why he has all the ingredients of a cult player, is that firstly he's burst onto the scene at an advanced age, which is unconventional because typically it's a young player bursting onto the scene. He's unconventional in that his nickname's Lurch because of his height. I wouldn't call him particularly tall for athlete standards, but he, despite having a languid frame, he loves to dribble and he's very good at dribbling, and he's got a knack for the spectacular. I think one of the goals in this run was scored from the halfway line, pretty much.
Yeah, that was during his hat trick against Torino, and he's got the most hat tricks since he joined Atalanta in Serie A with 5. Or maybe 4, and this was his 5th for Atalanta, and it was away, and all of them have come away from home. So he's looking to shush opposition fans when they are allowed in the stadium.
Just another reason why he's your new favourite player. There's a great article on him by James Horncastle in The Athletic, which basically says that his nickname in the Atalanta squad is Grandma, because he's always knackered in training. And even in games, he's always asking Gasperini. I think they say in an Atalanta game against Juventus, he was on at Gasperini all second half to take him off. And Gasperini was kind of just shutting himself away, like not listening because we needed to keep him on. So he started badgering the assistant instead of trying to get him to take
him off. I'm right in saying Gasperini is renowned for his very high intensity training sessions as well.
Yeah, probably.
And he himself has been, obviously this is Atalanta's first ever Champions League campaign. We're talking about managers deserving a lot of credit. He is obviously not 32 years old, but someone as well that deserves immense amount of credit for having a style of play that is attracting the sort of neutrals to watch their games when their team isn't being played.
Oh, they're the most fun team in Serie A by a distance.
He's also had a really cool career, like Palermo to Fiorentina to Atalanta is like just really cult careers.
All of our cult combined 11s of how they could have lined up. Yeah, likes a nice kit.
And the colour gradient on that kit evolution is quite... Yeah. It goes from pink to viola to...
We know what we're going to be looking at afterwards.
On Atalanta, though, quickly, I would like to point out the defending in that game.
Yeah.
They obviously conceded 3 goals, but it looked very ropey. There's defensive errors in them, and I mean, that's not new to anyone who's watched them in Serie A this season. Yeah. So when considering them dark horses for this competition, I'd probably look at Leipzig as more dark horse ready, because they seem to have a bit more of a coherent system that leads to defensive stability, whereas with Atalanta, it's very much outscoring the opponent.
Which, as we said, makes it really fun to watch, and whoever they draw, it will be a complete contrast of styles if they were to draw Atletico Madrid.
That'd be horrible though, because Madrid were just 1-0.
That's what I mean. Is
you want to draw Barcelona because they can't defend either. So that's
Barcelona aren't through yet.
How many Atletico Madrid defenders they pack into that box when they're defending.
Yeah.
Combined with what you were saying about how many Atalanta players are in the box, you're probably going to have a situation where there's like 22 players in the box and no one else in any other part of the pitch, bar the goalkeeper, of course.
And the final thing to close on Ilicic is, if he does propel Atalanta even further into the Champions League, then again, I sort of Musa Okwonga was talking about it and saying that he'd wrote an article on it, and I replied with some more hat tricks and just sort of dropped in that he could be like this year's Tadic if he sort of keeps going and finds his way onto the top 30 of the Ballon d'Or, and then realised that a lot of people would, maybe it's because they both end with itch, again it's that easy comparison your brain
lefties
will make
too.
But yeah, both left-footed players scoring and assisting a lot of goals in teams that aren't considered to be heavyweights, so there's that comparison to be made as well. And the Papu party hasn't even started yet, so Atlanta could get even more fun. Jumping into another Champions League game before we move on to the Atletico versus Liverpool game, PSG Dortmund has been overshadowed by Neymar, Mbappe and company seemingly tearing into Erling Haaland for his yoga celebration.
That boy rattled them, didn't he?
Which shows that, again, there have been pictures, and we don't know if they've been sort of photoshopped themselves, of him, Haaland, apparently saying that Paris is his city before the game. But obviously something was said, or they just really disliked the fact that he scored two goals against them in the first leg. And every moment of celebration or glory in that game by PSG was celebrated in the yoga pose.
I think they just got carried away.
Yeah.
You can see the change room one is even more embarrassing from a PSG perspective and an Mbappe perspective when he's filming himself. And like, you can see the idea twig. Oh, let's do that thing again, because it's probably blowing up on social media.
Mbappe, you can say, is at least 21. He's about as young as Haaland. What annoys me is that, like, you've got 24-year-olds, 30, 28-year-olds coming over and joining. Like, what are you doing?
Well,
let the kids have their banter with each other. You just stay out of it.
I just think to do it on the pitch and then think that was funny, and then to go, oh, that was so great, let's do it again in the change room.
And they did it again on the pitch after as well, didn't they? There's that picture of them and like the whole squad doing that pose. I think Ander Herrera is the only one not doing it, and Thiago Silva as well. They're both sort of doing the old fist pump. Yeah. And then there's Julian Draxler looking really awkward about it, but still doing the pose.
The thing is, and the reason why they were so hyped, and this is perhaps the indictment of PSG. That's their first quarterfinal in 4 years.
Round of 16 win.
Yes, they've got to the quarterfinal for the first time. So they haven't celebrated a round of 16 victory in the last three seasons. So they were obviously hyped about it, and they overcame a deficit for the first time in their history after losing the first leg, obviously.
Normally they do it the other way around, normally.
Yeah, so for them, again, it's super childish, like why they honed in on this 19-year-old's celebration. And just quickly as well, Levin Kazawa should know a bit better, because he's got history in this.
John Guidetti.
Yeah, during the qualifiers for the Euro under-21s in 2015, France were 2-0 up in the first leg, and Kazawa had celebrated his goal or his involvement in a goal by doing a sort of salute, like miming to look for the Swedish players during the game. And then Sweden beat them 4-1 in the second leg and eventually won the tournament. So not only did they mock Kazawa when they beat them in the second leg, when they were given the winners' medals and the trophy all on the podium, they all did the exact same pose, which is probably the time to do it if you're going to do it.
Yeah, because I mean, PSG could get
And PSG down, could get knocked out, and you... It's now created some factions in which the team that they may or may not face in the quarterfinal, semi-final, or even final, they might then throw it back in their face, and it could start.
Well, I think you might see Haaland post on social media.
Maybe do the Mbappe arms folded one.
Yeah. It goes to show, like, if you're an athlete, that level of self-awareness probably holds you back in most cases. But that would be in my mind when I was like going to do that celebration. It's like, am I giving Haaland the assist to like dunk on me on social media at a later point?
I mean, this is what was so funny is I thought it was like the classic PSG that we've come to know, these sort of lovable doofuses who do stupid things, rather than what they actually were on the pitch, which was a very, very accomplished team. Like, they were so, like, it was so weird to watch, because normally PSG, you think they're frantic, they're panicked, they don't really know what they're doing. They were brilliant. And, I mean, okay, they were helped by Dortmund looking a bit flat. Maybe it was the fact there was no fans in the stadium, I don't know. But PSG were comfortable and in control the whole game. There was no, they played the away leg very, very, very cautiously, right? They were very afraid of getting blown off the park by Sancho, by Orlan, and I think with justified cause, because you look at how many attacks Dortmund did have anyway. If PSG hadn't gone maybe super cautious, they would have got blown away maybe, but because they went really cautious, they still lost in the end, obviously, but it was only 2-1, and they had that away goal, that Neymar goal. And then, of course, Neymar scored again. Opening the scoring here, diving header inside the 6-yard box.
Second Champions League header.
It's 100. For second knockout league goal for PSG. So they're paying 110 million euros per goal right now. Mm. So, you know, per knockout goal, I should say.
I was going to say, because his Champions League record.
Yeah, well,
is nuts.
I'm about to say that. Yeah, like literally, since he's joined PSG, it started 16-17. He's got 18 Champions League goals, which is tied for sixth in the Champions League. It was a 26.47 shot conversion, which is also tied for sixth, which is minimum of 40 shots. 15 assists, which is first. And that'll be doubly impressive in a minute, I'll tell you something.
I'd say that's the one you should have gone with. Well, it's more than sixth most goals.
No. It's a picture. I'm painting a picture. Tapestry. 80 chances created, which is second. 18 big chances created, which is joint third. 153 dribbles, which is first. 103 fouls won, which is first. And all of this despite only playing 2,274 minutes. So he's played less than basically everyone else who's up there, except for one player, which is Kylian Mbappe, who has 19 goals, which is 25th, 12 assists, which is second, 19 big chances created, which is also second. So, like, those two are just ridiculous.
That's their little group stage.
But then they
padding,
did have Celtic in.
Yeah. I mean, obviously a lot of that is based in the groups. But the point is, you know, Neymar, for all the, I mean, I've been a big critic of his move to PSG because I felt he hasn't moved the needle enough for them. And part of that is because injuries, right? But staying fit is part of being a footballer. Whether that's fair or not, it is. And he hasn't been able to stay fit at all. He hasn't looked dedicated to PSG. He's looked very unprofessional with some of the timings of some of his suspensions and injuries coincide with Carnival and his sister's birthday and whatever. Everyone's got all jokes. But the point is
so boring as well.
It's rote now. It's boring. But the point is, you know, it's like I personally have wanted Neymar for ages to sort of like go back to the Neymar he was when he was last season at Barcelona, and when he is fit for PSG, where he just looks like he's the second best player in the world when he's fit. It's not even close. He's so good. And those numbers are ridiculous. How little football he's played, and he's got the most assists in the last 3 years of Champions League football. PSG haven't made it past the knockout rounds once, and he's like...
Well, that's because they keep breaking records for most goals in a group stage.
Yeah, but he's so good. And this is what I'm saying. And we finally saw it last, because it wasn't just that he scored the goal, diving header, 6-yard box, which is a fantastic goal. It wasn't just that he played a part in the second goal where he threaded a nice ball through. It was the fact that he took the team on his back. Mbappe didn't start because he wasn't fully fit after his recent illness, which wasn't coronavirus, but, you know. Mm. So and Cavani was obviously on, but he's getting on a bit.
And he played a role in the sense
he did play a role. And I mean, he missed a good, great chance early on, but it was
good
just,
save.
It was a good, well, yeah, but the Cavani of old buries that. It doesn't go low, it goes high, and the keeper's already going down. Anyway. Neymar took the team on his back. He led the team. He was like, from the first minute, he was running at Dortmund to the point where they were just petrified and whacking him with some pretty tasty fouls. And he was milking it as he always does, going down. My wife was laughing. I'm like, didn't he get embarrassed? And I was like, no, that's part of what he does. He's putting them on edge and influencing the referee to be like, ooh, okay, they're really hurting this guy, even though they weren't really.
Well, he ended up, Chan got sent off.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, Neymar really was lucky to avoid, because he put his head into Chan there, which so I was surprised that didn't at least get a yellow for him. But anyway, he took the team on his back. He carried them in the way that we wanted him to carry them. And not to say that he was like some sort of remarkable and miraculous performance. It was almost, I wrote about this last night, it was almost mundane. It was like, oh yeah, you are the second best player in the world. So you should be carrying your team to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. It's what you do. You know, your team needs you to perform. You step up and perform. It's not like amazing, isn't it great thing. It's like, yeah, obviously. We've been expecting you, Neymar. Where have you been? You know, Neymar in a PSG shirt finally arrived last night in the sense that This is the guy they signed, the one that moves the needle, that carries them forward in Europe.
The one that
does
leads
the business.
Remontadas rather than
exactly.
the victim of them.
And the Haaland celebration is like kind of
sullied it.
Kind of sullied it because he made you think, oh wait, are they really like that, or was it just that Dortmund were nervous? Were they really mature? Have they matured, or are they just still the same club? Yeah.
When you step back and think of it, though, I think it does enrich the competition to have like a pantomime villain.
Oh, it's fun. It's definitely fun, especially as all the other villains are going to go out. Now. Yeah. Oh, no, Bayern Munich are going to go through, I guess. But yeah, all the other villains are going to go out probably. Maybe Barcelona might. Anyway, the point is,
stop saying all the villains are going out and then remembering there are other villains.
Okay, yeah. Well, anyway, the point
is, let's discuss then PSG's, again, we don't know the full quarterfinal lineup yet anyway, but as it were, again, and as we say, if the competition isn't suspended,
yeah.
A lot of hypotheticals based on this tournament now. But did they show enough in that in those two legs? I remember we spoke before the game, Will, and I was asking you, like, what do you think is going to happen? And I said they're both sort of got reputation for not doing great in big games. And you said that because Dortmund had potentially more to lose than it would be PSG.
Yeah.
So nailed that pretty much. Do you think that the PSG's... Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Dortmund players were asked. It might have been last season. It was a stage where they had established a lead over Bayern Munich and then relinquished that lead. I think it was Marco Reus expressed frustration with the number of occasions on which he's being asked about whether there's a mentality weakness in the Dortmund team. And obviously that implies that he doesn't think there is a mentality weakness in the team. But either way, the questions were being asked. So Dortmund have that reputation. PSG, we know, have that reputation. I refer to them as the Kingmakers, Champions League Kingmakers on our Champions League preview pod, because if you go back through the list of recent winners of the competition, they would either play PSG or play PSG twice in their group. I think Dortmund were also another team that I tried to combine to hit on a trend whereby all the recent Champions League winners of the last decade or so had either played one of those two teams. So that just made me think, it's interesting that dynamic of actually having a lead is also, as you said, having something to lose. So that could count against them.
So PSG are going to win the Champions League.
I mean,
the King made themselves. Yeah, the first four teams through are really interesting when you've got Leipzig, PSG, Atletico and Atalanta, all very different tactical setups, different levels of experience.
And the teams have
different threats.
The Champions League has been open for a while. 16-17 Madrid were by far the best team, along with Bayern Munich. Last season, Liverpool were probably, they were the best team, right? Up there with Barcelona, and they beat Barcelona, and then they were the best team. So they won it. And so but this season, because Liverpool are out.
Barcelona, best team last season
in the Champions League, they were very good.
And you wanted their manager.
I don't like because they can be better, Jake. Why be good when you can be great?
But I just the sort of contradictions. I find really odd.
It's fine. It's fine. It's understandable. But
I don't think Barcelona are the best team in the competition.
That's what I mean.
But anyway, to go back to the point as to whether Paris Saint-Germain are genuine contenders, of course they are. I would lean towards, and this assumes that Manchester City can, well, it assumes that the game goes ahead next week, but it assumes Manchester City can finish the job against Real Madrid. I just think, and obviously they are another team that have had a mental block with regards to the Champions League. Mm-hmm. I just think that win over Real Madrid is huge game changer. Like if you want a Champions League scout, Real Madrid are the team to get it against because of their recent history of just dominating the competition. So I think that's a huge one. And I also think with Guardiola's record in finals, and Manchester City's record in finals, they've played so many of them, and it's all been largely the same players. So that experience that they've they've developed in what is usually a very rare experience playing a final. I think if they get to the final, then that just makes them overwhelming favourites in a way that
I wouldn't
extend to Paris Saint-Germain.
The one thing you say about City, who also gets many finals, Atletico Madrid in the competition,
and that's who we're going to talk about next. So after having another little break, another little pause, before we talk about Atletico Madrid, there is another update regarding the pandemic at the moment. And we're crossing live to the right-hand side of me in the black T-shirt, Ollie Young-Miles. What have you now seen on your phone?
So the latest development is that all players at an unnamed Premier League club are today being tested for coronavirus after three first-team players displayed symptoms. So that's the Telegraph reporting that. Test results are expected back tomorrow, so we could be in danger of this weekend, maybe, of the fixtures being played this weekend. But obviously, that's jumping to conclusions a little bit. But
we'll have to see
the results.
It's interesting that if it follows the Real Madrid precedent of one team having to self-isolate, La Liga took the decision to suspend all match weeks or all teams involved in the next two match weeks. So it will be a good indicator of how the Premier League deem. How serious they deem this particular case to be and what their action is.
So yeah, that report actually says the player that first showed symptoms for it was immediately placed in self-isolation and then seems to be getting better and then has since relapsed. Okay. And two more players have displayed symptoms as well. Mm. So
again, maybe by the time we finish up, there'll be another update, but that's the latest we can leave you with that. And that means we now do turn to Liverpool's elimination from the Champions League. No one expected that, really. The reign of Champions of Europe is over.
I think a few people expected that. I was talking to Sam last night. He thought Liverpool were going out. It's just the manner in which it happened. It was perhaps unexpected.
Maybe people were expecting it more after they lost the first leg. But I mean, in general, when the draw was made, there was but, every assumption that Liverpool would have enough to break down the wall. And even then, they did manage to get the two goals.
I think setting aside most of extra time, that is Liverpool's best performance of the year and is one you would maybe turn to as a source of encouragement if the wider implications of it or the ensuing events of extra time weren't so catastrophic, and the wider implication being that they're no longer able to defend their European crown. I think tactically Klopp nailed the midfield selection in particular, because we were discussing this on last week's episode, whether to take Fabinho out. But there's also a question: if you draw Henderson back into that holding role to replace him, then which two midfielders do you pair either side of him? I think, as I said, he nailed it. The plan was clearly to test Atletico Madrid's defenders' concentration by basically playing musical chairs with all the positions. I know Liverpool are quite a fluid team who rotate. You've obviously got Alexander-Arnold overlapping on frequent occasions, but I can't remember the last time I saw them rotate so speedily, so effectively to this extent. In particular, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Salah, and, as I said, Alexander-Arnold executed this plan to a T on that right-hand side, because I think Lodi had the toughest job of the night. You just didn't know who was going to be streaming down that flank, and indeed I think it's Oxlade-Chamberlain, who you'd think Klopp dropped in there because he's Liverpool's biggest goal threat, and you did obviously see him like firing off shots from range on occasion, but it was actually Wijnaldum who was like streaming into the box, and Oxlade-Chamberlain was rotating with the attackers on the right-hand side, delivers the cross for that Gini Wijnaldum header after 43 minutes.
That was such a clever little move.
His fifth goal in the Champions League.
What you said?
And I wouldn't be surprised. Loads of them were important, obviously, because he scored a couple in the Barcelona ones. But if there are headers, because
three headers.
Yeah. I mean, he's very good in the air, but it was so smart, because, like you said, you expect Upson in the middle, so the Atletico defensive midfielders aren't tracking Wijnaldum because they're busy moving out wide to try and cope with all the massive movement out there, and it just leaves him in space. Yeah. And it's a great. I mean, Klopp said last match we want to do first time crosses, because that catches defenders unaware.
And Firmino was like trying to create space by like dragging Thomas Partey quite wide.
Wonderful.
And also for Firmino's goal, it was Gini Wijnaldum, who I just said spent his I think his instructions for the night was he was playing on that left-hand side, but it was to like go operate in the channel or quite central areas and get in. But it was actually him who provided the cross for Firmino's goal.
Yeah, ran
I think that's circumstantial, just based on like how the ball's been moved around.
But imagine you're wearing a Netherlands shirt, Gini.
Exactly, yeah. Because I think he's got like 12 goals for the season overall.
He's their chief goal threat. With Memphis playing as a false nine, he would constantly get in the box and score goals. Mm.
But the mistake from Adrian breaks the game. To use a Mourinho term from the Barcelona leg of last year. I actually think Atletico Madrid have a lot of things to get right before that misplaced pass ends up in the back of the net. You might have seen the screenshot, by the way, of where Adrian should have passed. Yeah, I think Robertson's out on the left. Yeah. And it actually looks like that has the potential to develop into quite a dangerous attack for Liverpool's point of view. But the ball obviously goes into midfield. The Atletico Madrid midfielder, who I can't quite remember.
João Félix
picks it up, plays the pass. And then the defender's not quite on Llorente quickly enough to stop the shot. And also, I think, as much as the pass is bad, it's the attempted save that looks worse.
The pass is, you can make a bad pass and get away with it, because it should be a routine save. But his leg just sort of falls out from underneath.
He seems to fumble a little bit.
I mean, that was the error for me. The pass was whatever. You can make a bad pass. Every goalkeeper, even the best passing goalkeepers in the world, have made bad passes. It's the way he just doesn't recover from it at all.
I think it was a bad decision, though, wasn't it? Like we were just saying, if that goes back to Alisson, he takes a touch to his left and then pings it out.
Yeah.
So it was bad decision making, followed by bad execution, followed by not saving this.
Another bad bit of execution. But now, Marcus Llorente, who before that,
my boy Marcus Llorente.
Okay. Claim just
well, no, I've just thought I've been.
Did you discover? Okay. Did you discover him?
I was going to say.
Yes, I discovered him. Mate, he's descended from Real Madrid royalty. So I definitely did not discover him. He's Paco Gento's his great uncle.
But that was his first ever shot on target in the Champions League,
isn't it? He had 3 career goals before last night.
Yeah,
he's involved in 3 career goals, and he bagged 2 goals and an assist. He was excellent. And
I think the second one. His second goal is a really, really good finish.
Yeah. It's a brilliant goal.
You maybe can't like that at Adrian's door. No. But then the third goal is poor for
I was watching the move happen. I was like, oh, good, pass to him there. And I thought, oh, it's a shame there's no Atletico player on the left because otherwise this could be a goal. And you're thinking, you've defended him well. It's Gomez has shuffled him well. He's like not really got an angle to shoot. And he just pings it past him. It's a brilliant goal. Yeah. You know, Adrian, the thing is, right, when you Liverpool have this entire season, bar a handful of games, played very fine margin football. Like they win, and they know how to win, but it's always the fine. Everyone has to play really well. Everyone has to be really on the ball, really focused to deal with the pressure. And they've done that excellently. Their mental strength is off the charts. But you know, when you have a weakness, if you're playing on the fine margins and you have a weakness in your team, and it just gets exposed so brutally. Liverpool's great, to their enormous credit. They haven't had that all season. But Adrian is definitely a weakness. They masked it brilliantly earlier in the season.
He's a weakness in as much as that he's a backup goalkeeper.
Yeah,
go in on him that hard.
I'm not trying to rat.
He's not probably having a very nice time at the moment.
No, I don't want to carry.
And also, and this is maybe an indictment of previous backup goalkeepers that Liverpool have. But he's a step up. He's not as good as if we'd kept Lloris Karius, which was never really going to happen.
No, I know.
But he's better than Adam Bogdan. And
his problem at the moment, though, is the mistakes he's making are being punished. Like the Chelsea goal, the Willian one in the FA Cup was exactly the same. Hit straight at him, and he's parried it into his own net.
Goalkeepers have defined Jurgen Klopp's Champions League career at Liverpool, because in the first season they made the final, and then Lloris Karius had made his mistake that seemingly ended his career there as well, which was a sad moment to see. But they recovered from that.
Especially given how Klopp has a reputation for standing by players.
But he's coming back to Liverpool, isn't he? Because Besiktas aren't going to take up their option to buy him.
But you would imagine that the damage was done based on some of the horrible stuff that was then thrown his way. You wouldn't want to associate with that, and you'd want to move on from that. But that's just another point beyond that. And then they bought in Alisson because of it, arguably one of the best goalkeepers in the world at the time anyway, and then cemented himself as the best goalkeeper in the world, winning the Champions League, making 8 saves in the final, which is the most whilst keeping a clean sheet on record. And then this season, he gets injured, and Adrian, who has conceded 8 goals in 3 Champions League appearances for Liverpool, makes an error that leads to one of the goals that, despite doing the hard work, finally breaking down the Atletico Madrid wall, as we said, finally putting 2 goals past Oblak, who again is often considered the best alongside Alisson, depending which type of goalkeeper you prefer.
Almost depending on which ones more recently had the good game.
There are 4 elite goalkeepers. I think the funny thing is, I think Thibaut Courtois has been better than both in the season for Real Madrid. If you've watched him, he's been lights out. Of course, he's now injured as well, and that was a big part. That's a big problem for Real Madrid. Well, maybe not now with the season suspended, but that was going to be a big problem for Real Madrid against Man City. But I don't want to carry us, Alisson. Adrian. It's not like, you know, he didn't try to make the mistake. You know, it was an accident. But it's just.
I mean, they never.
I know. But that's what I'm saying.
They'd be banned from football by FIFA.
They're not William Gallas. But, you know, it's just. Or what William Gallas threatened to do, sorry, if you're old enough to remember that. It's the risk factor. Liverpool don't really play with that much risk because of the way they play. But it's almost like when you play on those fine margins, eventually, if you have a weakness in your team, they will be exposed. That's why Klopp has been so. That's why he figured out, okay, I've got to keep playing Trent, because if I put a defender out there, objectively, that's quote unquote reduces risk, but it doesn't. It increases risk because then we don't play our normal game and we concede chances. It's why Joe Gomez has just sidelined everyone else now, because him alongside Van Dijk is objectively, they're just so good together. They cover each other's weaknesses.
There's just so much pace in that.
Yeah, they're just a phenomenal side. And I mean, I think it's the weird thing, because honestly, for 100 minutes, was it? 95 minutes, Liverpool were just fantastic. Just absolutely flawless. This was not, I mean, and this is what I was saying. I've been saying all the games, I don't. This is not it's not a vintage Atletico Madrid side. This is not 2014. It's not even like 2017 Atletico Madrid. They're nowhere near that level. Liverpool will beat them easily because they don't. And Simeone goes too defensive too early, which is what he did immediately from the first whistle. They're like, they had that great attack right at the start. João Félix played in Costa.
They had a really dangerous. So I think they demonstrated how you control a game through a combination of pressing well, which they did, and just like standing in the right places to shepherd the opponent's time on the ball into a cycle of sterile possession. But for most of the game, the tactics weren't working, and they had quite a dangerous moment, a few minutes around the half-hour mark. But immediately after that, Liverpool start growing into the game, culminating in Gini Wijnaldum's header in the 43rd minute.
It's like you said to me, this wasn't Simeone's game plan working.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, it was from then on till Llorente's goal. It was. They were defending like in not very intelligent ways. It was hoofs, headed clearances, which is not what you want to do against teams like Liverpool or teams like City, because the ball is just going to come straight back on you in a matter of seconds, and you've not really bought that much time.
It was like scramble defence, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was like when the ball was in the danger area, they all sort of rushed to that position, and Oblak happened to be in the right place at the right time to bail them out.
I mean, a lot of what Atleti have done under Simeone does look like it's panicked, but a lot of it is measured. But the thing, what they've lost is, if you go back and look at how they beat Barcelona and Bayern Munich in 2015-16 on the way to the final, the way they handled those attacks there was a degree of like just get it out, but their positioning was so much smarter than they shut down attacks. They limited opposition chances to have shots at their goal, and so yes, it was still defensive, it was still this and that, but it wasn't like holding on by the seat of their pants.
Where they faced a barrage yesterday.
Literally, if Salah and Mane have an even slightly better game, then that game...
If they finished as well as Atletico Madrid's defensive midfield.
If the chances didn't fall to Robertson as well, header,
I mean, that
the one on the edge of the box.
That was poetry after his comments after the first leg, I thought. But other than that, it's just...
On his birthday as well.
Yeah. Well, that's unfortunate. You don't want that to happen to anyone. But
so, yeah, Liverpool. So the point that you were sort of trying to make as well, I think, getting around it, is that they've won a lot of the games by fine margins by doing enough. And the irony is that when they absolutely smash aside and have 34 shots and 11 on target, somehow it's not only because obviously even if it was 2-2 they would have been out, but they ended up losing that game as well. Klopp's first ever Champions League defeat at Anfield is now ticked off. It's the first time he's lost a two-legged knockout tie in European competition. And all of the positives in terms of creating all those chances are now morphed into some sort of weird negative criticism of the side, because they had 34 shots. They put in 65 crosses, which they played 120 minutes, is the most that we can look back and see a team has crossed the ball in a single Champions League game since 2016-17. And because they didn't win, that's now perceived as bad, because there are a lot of people that seem to be waiting to call Liverpool sort of one-dimensional, cross-focused teams.
Never look at the result. Always look at the game, the performance. And Liverpool were excellent. Yeah, and it's like Klopp said it after the match. He was like, we played great. We just made the mistakes.
Because there was also a Trent Alexander-Arnold stat about the amount of times he lost possession, and we addressed on last week's podcast. But he himself created the most chances on the pitch. Yeah. So again, yes, he may lose possession, but he could have picked up another 3 assists and we would have been talking about a completely different performance from him. And it's just odd to see people so ready. And maybe this is because a lot of my stuff is focused on social media, which can be quite a bad place anyway. But it's just so damning that in a game in which Liverpool, they've not played as well as that this season and comfortably won games, and then the season in which they sort of, you said, executed a game plan perfectly and was undone by the result at the
end. When you're on top, people want to see you fail. When Man United were dominant, everyone loved it. When they stopped, when Barcelona were dominant, when Bayern Munich was on, when you're dominant, but Real Madrid, everyone loves it when you fail. Like everyone loved it when Real Madrid lost to Ajax last year. Everyone's like, yeah, great.
A holder's out again in the last 16.
Yeah, I mean, and Liverpool, last time Liverpool were Champions League, defending Champions League winners, by the way, they lost in the round of 16.
To Benfica.
At Anfield. But then it's to Benfica, to our Barcelona rejects. Samuel scored. This time it's Real Madrid rejects. Marcus Llorente and Alvaro Morata, two Real Madrid rejects this time.
This game like perfectly encapsulated Pep Guardiola's comments about Champions League, knockout football in general, in that
how
just
Liverpool
a freak
just proved
moment.
Pep Guardiola right. Oh,
yeah, exactly. Like one freak moment or like one error here or there is it, and that's it, done. Liverpool battered Atletico Madrid, but they just happened to have their understudy goalkeeper in when Alisson's, I think, going to be fit for the weekend or at least the game after that. So it's just, it is such fine margins, and this was just
I think you were making the point on maybe another pod where we were talking about Liverpool's success in Champions League about how they thrive in chaotic situations. This season has definitely been a concerted switch towards control.
Yeah.
So that's one interpretation of it. How much of a say in the actual outcome that has had is you can never really gauge, but it's definitely they've what has previously served them well in the chaotic, the ultimate chaotic competition, which is the Champions League competition, which the best team rarely ever, well, doesn't rarely win, but is less likely to win as it, when compared to a domestic league season, has counted against them in the form of these freak smash and grab goals that Atletico Madrid knocked them out with.
So with the Champions League last 16 deciders, or the first round of those at least, now fully discussed, with no more updates before we jump into this section. So we're hoping at the moment that there will be some Premier League football this weekend, whether there'll be fans there to see it or not, we still don't know. But as always, to put some predictions that are probably going to be wrong on the BetBall accumulator at the end of the podcast. Well, go on then. What was your one last week?
Man United win.
It was 1-0 though, is what you said.
I did say 2-1.
I think you've got to give them that.
No, you can give it to him, but I'm saying that the nature
of them. But the bookmaker's not going to give you.
Yeah, exactly. So, as we say in with all the predictions, is maybe we try too hard. So yeah, if we did Man United win, you would have been absolutely correct. So, you've triggered me and derailed where I'm going, because none of us have been very good on the predictions in general. So yeah, as I said, on BetBall you can follow us, but we've not really sold ourselves that well, and the good thing about BetBall is you can follow other people that do better accumulators and have their own rankings. So download that, the link will be in the bio of the podcast. But to kick us off on these predictions that you're now desperate to hear, we're going to stay on the Liverpool theme, because there's a Merseyside derby on the horizon. And Everton, I don't know if you saw Atletico Madrid sneaking an Everton flag
into
the end. Yeah. That's the first Everton win at Anfield since 1999.
What a weird flex for Atletico.
It worked. So
could it usher in their first derby win in all competitions since 2010, October 2017. At that point, Ancelotti was actually at Chelsea. It was about seven months.
The Hodgson era?
Yeah, I think it must be. Yeah. So Ancelotti's at Chelsea, sacked 7 months later, a couple hours after losing at Goodison Park as Chelsea manager. So that's a source of pessimism for Everton, to counterbalance the optimism that this Atletico Madrid win gives them. I spoke to Chris Smith, one of our writers, before this. He's not pinning too much hope on seeing Atletico Madrid.
They were so bad against Chelsea.
And he is, I think, of the more pessimistic bent when it comes to supporting his team anyway. He was going for 3-1 Liverpool. So if you want the opinion of an Everton fan, then maybe side with that one. They're actually on a 7-game unbeaten run at home in the Premier League, conceding a quite respectable 5 goals in that time while scoring 11 goals themselves, of which Dominic Calvert-Lewin has scored 6. Only against Arsenal and Brighton did he not find the net. So he's a candidate.
Arteta's at the wheel.
I was going to say, if Lovren plays, which is not very likely, then he's that kind of big centre forward that likes a physical challenge. Liverpool, on the other hand, have lost their last three away games in all competitions, and were scraping wins by pretty much before that. If you remember the Norwich 1-0 win,
I have.
It's not so long ago they drew 2-2 to Shrewsbury.
Yeah, I would
with a much weaker team.
Imagine they're going to reap the whirlwind here. This is Liverpool knocked out the Champions League. They played brilliantly. They're going to unload on poor Everton. I think this is going to be absolute massacre.
And this is the only thing they've got now.
Yeah. They'll want to win it in the most emphatic fashion possible, and they are miles better than Everton. And Everton aren't playing well, and I mean if you watch the Chelsea, they were so bad against Chelsea.
Yeah, exactly. They played badly in that game.
It was almost like a parody of Everton, like how bad they were. Literally, the only moment of quality was Richarlison had this really good run and pass to Calvert-Lewin, who missed. They were so bad, and I just think Liverpool again, because they went out, they didn't go out in a demoral, in a like they were rubbish and they just got battered or something, or like in a really sort of mentally breaking way, like the way what they did to Barcelona last season. They went out with their heads held high. They dominated the game with just defensive mistakes cost them.
That could be worse though.
No, like, I think
we do all of this and we still can't win.
No, I think
especially if you look at the fact that they're probably still going to be playing Adrian in goal.
I can't speak to Adrian, but I think Liverpool will absolutely massacre Everton. They beat Everton every time anyway. I think that's the other thing. It's like
the only thing with that Everton game of the weekend, I think they went 2-0 down, and Everton haven't really got anything to play for. I mean, they could maybe sneak into a European place.
Before that game, they were like, can we dream sort of a European spot?
But they kind of went 2-0 down, and you just thought, okay, they've sort of given up here, save themselves for next week. I think I can't see Liverpool battering them. Recent Merseyside derbies have been pretty low on goals. Obviously, Everton drew against them last year.
Yeah, that was Marco Silva.
Yeah, true. It was 0-0, wasn't it? Corresponding fixture last season.
Yeah. Before that 5-2 was a freak because it had there was like three consecutive.
And that was Silva
0-0s.
On the brink as well, wasn't it? I mean, they weren't playing for him or anything by that point.
As you're a self-proclaimed sage of predictions, Mark, I'm going to absolutely pile on some pressure here and give you a chance to live up to it.
4-1 Liverpool.
Right. Remember that, listeners.
1-0 Liverpool.
I'm abstaining because I'm not a self-proclaimed prediction wizard. We have enough there to go off, so I can leave it at that. Was there anything else you wanted to add on that game?
Yeah, I think just from those two perspectives, Liverpool's bad away form, Everton's home form, I, like Ollie, don't think it's going to be a completely one-sided affair. I would narrowly back Liverpool on actually exactly the same as Ollie on a 1-0 win.
Nice. The other big game this weekend is...
Oh, no.
Again, returning to, it's quite nice that we've spent a lot of time speaking about Spurs and Liverpool, and they're the two predictions that we're mainly going to focus on. A chance to rewrite all the wrongs against Manchester United. Ollie grimacing already. I've not even said it yet. Spurs versus Man United. Obviously, the Champions League places, we still don't know what's happening. We still don't know if the season's going to finish, etc. There is a lot to play for in the Premier League still. One win within that cluster of places can take you three positions up the table and make you dream once again. Will Spurs be dreaming once again, Ollie?
I can't see it. I can't really see it at the moment. The thing is, you know, they against Liverpool and Man City, that was a clear game plan of sitting in tight and hoping to get something on the counter. But Spurs don't really have the counter-attacking weapons to really do that against Manchester United. Lucas is the only real sort of quick player that they can try and feed on the counter and hope that Dele can hold the ball up. Yeah.
But previous against Manchester United.
The only thing for Spurs is if Martial isn't fit enough to play. Obviously, he clattered into the post when he was closing down Edison at the weekend. He's going to miss tonight's game against LASK. So that could be something that swings things in Spurs' favour a little bit. But I just think Man United have got so many players in good form. Fernandes has been brilliant. Defensively, they've tightened up massively recently as well. They look really solid at the back. McTominay's come back in, and Fred's been playing really well. At Spurs,
Matic as well.
Yeah, Matic has been great. Yeah, and Spurs, we sort of touched upon earlier, the only one playing well at the moment is Lo Celso, and he can't do it all by himself. So, yeah, I think United have to be considered favourites. Spurs could maybe get a draw out of it, but I can't see them winning at the moment.
I mean, they'll have a 48 hours more rest, which probably will be a factor. But I think, as I was saying, Liverpool went out of the Champions League with their heads held high. Spurs went out in a really demoralising way. They were just outclassed all over the pitch, anything there. And I think it's very hard, especially with the way Mourinho reacted to it, it's very hard to see them sort of bouncing back from it and being like, yeah, we'll show them. Because, like...
I mean, especially when he's spoken about injuries so much, it almost gives them an excuse.
Yeah,
and you've got one team coming into it on a high, having beaten City and actually beaten them by out-footballing them. Recent Man United wins against City have been counter-attack or moments of luck that have sort of decided the game, whereas on Sunday they were the better side all departments and deserved
it. And this is all because of...
The big game ballista, isn't it? They took down the Dragons of the Premier League. This is the thing. Man United,
you'll need to explain what the big game ballista is, man.
Oh, is that Game of Thrones reference?
Yes.
Great.
And back before it was awful.
To be really clear, recently we've been looking at...
Well, exactly coinciding with the point it became awful. It was a ballista and a dragon.
but it's not become awful for Man United because we're talking, of course, about a formation or at least a tactical setup in which they seem to deploy for these big games. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has a brilliant record in the big games this season. It's the first ever Premier League double over Chelsea. It's their first Premier League double over Manchester United. Manchester City, sorry, since 2009-10.
Yeah.
Arsenal, the only team.
Yeah, the only big team, and I tell you
Liverpool,
why.
Obviously, they didn't beat
because
them as well.
No, but I mean they actually engaged Liverpool. They were never really in it. And the reason this is what I'm saying: the big game ballistic. At the start of the season, they were playing 43-1 in big games, and they won them basically because Marcus Rashford is amazing, and he scored like I think eight of the eleven goals. But obviously, they lost to Arsenal. They drew with Arsenal. They lost to Arsenal on New Year's Day with Rashford and team playing 43-1 because they could not get a hand on Nicolas Pepe at all. He destroyed them. That was like the one guy me thinking, oh God, here we go. This is the arrival of Nicolas Pepe. Tortured Luke Shaw. And I think since then, Rashford got injured. And I think as a result of Rashford getting injured, Solskjaer's like, oh, I can't play 43-1. I've got no one I can put in that position. So he switched to 3-5-2, which he used against Liverpool. Previously, it was just a formation he brought into Liverpool, which I think he got the idea from Sheffield United because they did it. Mm. Well, that's their formation. And they shut Liverpool down very well because Sheffield United's wing-backs basically pressed back Liverpool's full-backs, Alexander-Arnold and Robertson, and prevented them from influencing the game. And that's Liverpool's chief creativity.
Don't give away too much of the video that's going to be dropping anytime soon on a Twitter feed near you.
Watch the video. It's really good. And basically... United did the same thing with 3-5-2, and then Solskjaer brought it back again for Liverpool. It didn't work. They lost, but they competed the whole game. They were in it until right the last second when the goal they conceded was from a set piece, not from open play. So, and then he stuck with it for Chelsea, and they won because it shut down Chelsea, allowed them to push up and man-mark Jorginho, but keep the men on the flank. The forwards are fast and they can break into the flanks. Dan James plays well in the formation, and Martial does as well. And Bruno Fernandes instead of Jesse Lingard, that's just up the quality level immensely. He's so good playing between the lines, moving into space, playing on the break, playing with the ball as he did against City. He has moments of improvisational genius like the free kick, the little lifted free kick from Martial. And okay, Edison should have saved it. It was a bad bit of goalkeeping, but the idea behind the free kick, I think, deserved a goal. It was so ingenious. And I think
that's not how it bloody works.
No, it's not how it works, but it's how it should work. But
Martial did take it well, like, over the shoulders.
He did.
Like,
it's not
one
easy.
Of those classic things that strikers are always banging on about. Oh, that's the hardest skill in football, to hit a ball well on the volley over the shoulder. Yeah. He did connect well with it, but yeah.
This is the thing. Now you look at the way Spurs are set up, right? I can see him doing it again, 3-5-2, right? Attack the spaces. The Spurs' wide channels are a mess.
Well, probably be 5-3-2 v 5-3-2.
I mean, this is what you think. But Aurier, I mean, as showing as Leipzig, he's just a liability. Even in that formation, he's a liability. He's great going forward, but he's defensively a problem. They don't really have a left back. They're sort of putting square pegs in round holes, and it's kind of working, but it's not ideal.
One in six games.
Well.
Yeah, I suppose. It'll be Vertonghen probably.
I mean, they've got Lo Celso, and that's going to be a big, big plus for them. But at the same time, if United put out McTominay and Matic and Fred, they put all three of them in midfield recently. If they put those three in midfield again, one of them is going to be able to track Lo Celso and give him enough problems.
So that means Fernandes would have to be one of the two up front.
Yeah, I mean, they might do, if Martial's not playing, they might do that. They might have Fernandes and James as a two up front, or Fernandes and Ighalo. But or they might put Fernandes into the middle and then...
3-5-1-1.
The thing is, they have options. That's what's interesting. United haven't had options basically all season. They've got they can do it in one of two ways, and that's going to keep Jose Mourinho guessing. Mourinho will really want to get the win, obviously, because Man United.
He's not done well against his former clubs this season.
No, he has not. And I think, look, if Harry Kane was miraculously able to start or something, but he's not.
So I don't know why you even started.
Because he's back in training, isn't it? So like, if he suddenly pulled a, you know,
if he pulled
a Willis Reed and just randomly showed up, I'm starting today. You know, like when Rooney against Bayern Munich, where everyone's like, oh, he's out for a month and he's playing 4 days later. You know, then maybe, yeah, you'd think because he's got the quality and he's got an attack and Spurs could build something. But as it is, I think United will just have this situation. They'll defend deep. They'll block off Spurs' runs. They'll deal with the balls coming into the box pretty well. You'd imagine, obviously, anything can happen.
And if Sterling can't get past Wan-Bissaka, then no one can.
I mean, he's a shutdown corner. He's just unreal.
So what do you think?
I think, you know, let's say 1-0 United. Let's say 1-0.
Ollie?
Maybe 1-0.
And it doesn't have to be a score prediction. You can throw something really fun out there if you want.
I really don't know. I don't think Spurs will win, but it will either be 1-0 or 2-1 United. But
Will, do you have anything to...
2-1 United.
So a clean sweep for Manchester United. That hasn't happened a while on this podcast, has it?
No.
United haven't been good for a while, Jake. And,
well, maybe they're only good in these big games. That's something else
that's
discussed.
They are playing Spurs as well. Yeah. Like, they don't have to be good to beat Spurs.
Let's be honest. You can tell there's some fan pessimism behind some of that sentiment. But as we said, winless in six games. Man United in great form. That's one game to look out for this weekend if it goes ahead. Merseyside derby to look ahead. But after a long Champions League dive and Premier League little preview, that is all we do have time for on this week's Squawker Talker podcast. So thank you to my guests, Will.
No problem.
Mo.
See you next week, hopefully.
Ollie.
Thanks very much.
And as Mo said, hopefully we're speaking to you next week. Take care.